Exploring the small but determined minority Catholic community in the Central Asian country of Kazakhstan. Following the Felician sisters on their mission in Haiti to feed and clothe the poorest people in the Western Hemisphere.
They brought me here, and I thank God the moment they did.
A discussion of palliative care as an alternative to euthanasia in Spain. And after a total COVID lockdown of more than a year, we go to Israel on one of the first pilgrimages allowed back in the Holy Land. EWTN News In Depth brings you the world.
Hello, and welcome to this special edition of EWTN News In Depth. I'm Montse Alvarado. The reach of our global Catholic Church is limitless. And since its launch in 2020, News In Depth has sought out those peripheries and brought you, our viewers, insights on Catholicism and religion around the globe. Our program today is dedicated to highlighting some of our most compelling work. We begin with a flashpoint, the war in Ukraine. Here's reporter Colin Flynn.
On the grounds of the Ukrainian Greek Catholic Church in the town of Bucha, just outside Kiev, three priests from the U.S. stand and pray. They are praying at the site of a mass grave where 30 people were buried after the fighting started when the Russians invaded. The priests stand here, trying to take in the reality of what's in front of them. One of the priests is Father Israel Perez.
It's an hard experience for me. I can't imagine how good people can die in this way. It's hard. It is hard. Very sad.
Another is Father Sebastian Sardo.
Here I feel the cold, but the cold in my heart. I never in my life thought I can see a place like this.
They are being led by Monsignor Kieran Harrington, the National Director for the Pontifical Mission Societies in the U.S.
Today is Good Friday, and our Lord was hung up on a cross as a criminal and laid in an unmarked grave. And then you think about an unmarked grave, what can you say?
Monsignor Harrington, Father Sebastian, and Father Israel are on a mission from the U.S. Pontifical Mission Societies to bring aid and supplies to the Ukrainian people.
This is unbelievable. We're here outside this apartment block, outside Kiev, and you can see, we think tanks or heavy artillery have taken out huge chunks of the wall. All the windows are shattered. Just unbelievable destruction that has been left in the path of the Russians.
It's horrifying, isn't it? You really can't imagine the horrific effects of war. But the emotional destruction takes a long time to unpack.
First of all, being here, showing them my closeness, my love, and telling them that there are hope. I think that hope will win, always.
Outside an apartment block, where apartments on the top floors are still burnt out from bombing, a resident tells them that her son was serving in the military and died. The priests listen carefully as she recounts the nightmare of her building being attacked. There are still burnt bodies upstairs that haven't yet been retrieved, she tells them. other locals come over as well, you can see that they take comfort that the priests are here to listen. They give them aid and a blessing, and they continue on their journey. The group travels to Lviv in the west of Ukraine, where 170 refugees are taking shelter at the St. Joseph Bazilian Monastery and Seminary on the outskirts of the city. This seminary offers the refugees a safe haven for as long as they need. Father Israel gives the children beautiful cards made by children in Catholic schools in New York. The cards bring a smile to the children's faces. It's a small but kind gesture, offering messages of support and hope from other children their own age.
Alleluia, ora pro nobis Deum, alleluia.
And as dawn breaks on Easter Sunday morning, the local faithful come out in numbers at St. George's Cathedral in Lviv to celebrate the risen Christ. Monsignor Harrington, Father Israel, and Father Sebastian celebrate with the Ukrainian Greek Catholic Church in a beautiful ceremony, all the more meaningful and powerful at a time like this.
You know, the challenge always when you have an experience of this kind of aggression is that you can give yourself permission to hate. And God created us for love. I hope from our visit, what they found is that we were accompanying them, that we were walking with them during this Holy Week, that they weren't alone. Evil may have its day, but the kingdom is what is going to reign. And it's my hope that the people here continue to keep faith and hope in the Easter joy that is ultimately their promise.
In Ukraine, Colm Flynn for EWTN News in Depth.
Our intrepid correspondent Colm Flynn is by far the biggest world traveler on our staff here at EWTN News in Depth. And he's here now with us in studio all the way from home base at EWTN Vatican Bureau to take us along some of these stories that he's been covering. Colm, it's so great to have you here.
Monsi, first of all, this is strange because normally we're talking over a video link or I'm sending in a report. So it is a great pleasure to be here in the studio and in person with you.
Absolutely. Nothing better, especially post-COVID, than being in person.
Yeah, of course.
Colm, these stories have taken you around the world. Is this a reflection of our global church?
Yeah, one of the incredible things about doing this work, Monsi, is that myself and the team, we get to travel around the entire planet and bring these incredible Catholic stories to you and to the audience. And as you're about to see over the course of the program, we have covered so many different topics, so many different themes, and we have met some amazing people.
Yes, you have. Okay, amazing people. You get to interview cardinals, intellectuals, and also shopkeepers and people on the street. How do you choose what story to feature?
That's a good question. And you're right. The breadth of the people we get to interview is really what makes it so diverse and so interesting. But I always say to the team, Monsi, that passion beats everything. Mm. Someone can have the best PhD or be an expert in something, but someone can just have a passion for something and they will really sell it on television. So I think for us, when we're making these reports, is the person we're interviewing, do they have a passion for what they are doing? Is it in their heart? And often in the Catholic Church, the people who are helping those on the margins, as you will see, it's in their soul, it's in their heart, and that just comes across on television. You can't fake that.
You can't fake that, absolutely. You can't fake passion, but you also can't fake faith. Is that
yes.
also really important too?
Yeah, what I am struck time and time again as we bring these stories to the audience is the people you see in some incredibly difficult situations. Mm-hmm. We've just seen Ukraine. You're going to see South Sudan. You're going to see people who live lives that we couldn't even imagine how difficult they can be. And yet, time and time again, I hear people say, it's because of my faith I'm getting through this, or it's because of my faith I'm helping people get through this. So that is just a brilliant thing to be able to share and inspire people through this show who are watching all over the world.
Well, that's exactly what we want to do for our viewers. Let's take a quick look at some of your Middle East coverage.
Viva el Papa!
Viva el Papa!
Viva el Papa!
Viva el Papa!
In March of 2021, you traveled to Iraq with Pope Francis on one of the most significant journeys of his papacy, to the land of Abraham, the birthplace of Christianity. While in Iraq, the Pope met with the spiritual leader of the Shia Muslims, the Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani. During that historic encounter, Sistani shared with the pontiff his belief that Christians should be able to live in peace and have the same rights as other citizens. You also took our viewers to the Holy Land, where we visited with Sister Frida Nassar at the St. Louis French Hospital in Jerusalem. And we learned about this amazing facility which treats Christians, Muslims, and Jews, regardless of religion, and despite tensions felt outside its walls. And in Bethlehem, in the central West Bank, we visited the region's only neonatal ward at the Holy Family Hospital, steps from the birthplace of Jesus Christ. You spoke to the Order of Malta, which runs the hospital, another example of incredible cooperation across religions with the help of Catholic missions dedicated to serving all people. This cooperation between religions can be really tricky, especially in the Middle East, isn't it?
That's true, and just so beautiful seeing the images there and being reminded of all those incredible people. But when we went to the United Arab Emirates in the Middle East, the tricky thing there was hearing how the church works within the confines of what can sometimes be a very strict government. Mm. Yes, they have religious freedom, but to give you a quick example before we see the report, in a church where we interviewed a bishop, he did a wonderful interview about how the church can thrive their religious freedom. But when we stopped rolling, he said, "Cullum, look up at the ceiling of the church." And he pointed out six security cameras.
Wow.
And I said, "That's incredible, Father. You have an amazing security system here." And he said, no, Cullum, don't be naive. They are wired back to the government. So they're watching, they're listening, and that's the kind of environment that they exist in. But they have to be there to help many of the migrant workers as well who have built those cities in the United Arab Emirates.
Well, it's nothing new for the church to live under oppression.
Yeah, absolutely. And but just to see as well how they can kind of cleverly manipulate it and work within the limits. That's always interesting to see as well.
That's right. When we come back, how Catholicism survives in the Persian Gulf. Colm takes us to the United Arab Emirates next.
The desert country of the United Arab Emirates on the Arabian Peninsula. It's an ancient Bedouin land with civilization going back 6,000 years BC. The official religion here is Islam, brought by the Prophet Muhammad in 630 AD. Fast forward to today, and incredible cities of glass and steel have risen up from the desert sand to the sky. Today, 9.2 million people live here. Catholics make up 11% of that population. Most of them are foreign migrant workers, the laborers who have built these incredible cities. Bishop Paul Hinder is originally from Switzerland, but has been the apostolic vicar here in the UAE for 10 years.
Because we are a migrant church, we have no roots here in the country. It affects in the sense that, of course, it's not always easy to keep the continuity. We have priests who do normally not remain for a lifetime, except a few. For example, I am now one of the longest serving priests, not only bishop, here in the vicariate, and I'm here since 18 years.
Across the United Arab Emirates, there are currently 9 Catholic churches, with the main one being St. Joseph's in Abu Dhabi, the capital of the country.
St. Joseph's Church is the first church established in the United Arab Emirates.
This church was only built here in the 1980s, and before that, people had to practice their Catholic faith more quietly.
In 1960, people are celebrating masses only in their private houses. and the priests who were with them were coming from Bahrain.
It was illegal then, was it, to have a public celebration of the Mass?
Yeah, but there is no place yet for them to gather officially. And then in 1965, the first church in the United Arab Emirates, St. Joseph Church, was inaugurated and blessed.
Today, the United Arab Emirates claims to allow religious freedom. However, some restrictions still do apply. For example, Mass cannot be celebrated outside designated areas, that is, their churches. Sandra Alexander is an assistant professor of humanities at the American University in Dubai, teaching world cultures, philosophy, and ethics.
There are limitations on proselytizing, on sharing the faith kind of openly and publicly here. But for example, in my classrooms, when we talk about and read St. Thomas Aquinas together, I feel I'm able to speak the truth about my faith while at the same time just give information and perspective to my students.
Once we accept these limits, we can do quite a lot. Of course, there might be every now and then an interference, but I have no difficulties to go into the town with my religious Capuchin habit.
There is some minor difficulties, we may call it, but when it comes to expression of faith, almost 90% of what we had back home, we can still express here.
Expression of faith may be tolerated, but expression of opinion is harder to exercise if that opinion is critical of the government. For example, the treatment of migrant workers who often work in the sweltering heat for long hours and for very little pay. Such injustices the church would be quick to call out in other parts of the world.
Do you ever get a sense, as someone who goes to Mass every Sunday, listening to the homilies, mm-hmm. that sometimes they are restricted a mm-hmm. bit in terms of maybe mm-hmm. touching on things that could be social problems here, like labor workers or other problems that any country may have, mm-hmm. but here it's mm-hmm. maybe more difficult for the church to yes. talk about them and draw attention to them?
I think, I don't know if they're actively discouraged, if our clergy is actively discouraged by giving really local examples of social issues and how we might pray and aid the church or our fellow residents here
or call
who
out
are
what,
in need.
What the church thinks is wrong. Yeah.
Yes, I don't know if they're actively discouraged from doing so, but I do think they're cautious and careful about being too critical of the leadership in the country.
The church, in its own capacity, has been reaching out to our people in order to help them by giving them legal advices, by facilitating their material needs. But of course, we cannot do much as we had back home because of some limitations.
As the Catholic Church here continues to grow, as more migrants flock to the country for work, the lifestyle, and for the allure of riches, this means the local Emirati people, they will continue to be outnumbered in certain cities.
In general in the country, do you find that perhaps over the years there's been a reluctant tolerance to other religions, including the Catholic Church? Because of course when other religions and ways of thinking and ways of life come in, there always will be that erosion of
yes.
the Islamic faith, yeah. how people practice and believe here.
Yes, well this is a big concern in the Middle East, in the UAE particularly because of the fact that Emiratis are in the minority. There's a very small, relatively small compared to other groups of other nationalities here. They represent only maybe a fifth, less than a fifth of those who are living in the UAE, Emiratis do. And so I think there is this awareness and this desire to not just defend, but to preserve ideas, traditions, customs.
Despite the limitations, the Catholic Church here pushes ahead, trying to be an oasis of faith in what can be, for some, a very harsh desert.
I have seen the Spirit at work, and I am convinced he will continue to do that. What happens now here I'm not sure, maybe one day there is no more a church in Arabia, could be. But that doesn't mean that our life was useless. I think we have fulfilled our mission right now, and the rest, let it be to the one who is the Lord of the church.
In the United Arab Emirates, Colm Flynn, EWTN News in Depth. How do you ensure that the money you send out and allocate is used properly?
From an explanation of Vatican finances, an intricate and arcane web that Pope Francis is trying to make more transparent with the establishment of the Vatican Council for the Economy.
To be brutally honest about it, it's not clear how funds have been flowing and how they've been managed because the transparency hasn't been there.
You should be very aware that the people working with the money understand the mission. If you separate both, you may have a lot of money, but you may lose the mission.
To talking with a young man about devoting years of his life in service to the Pope as a member of the Swiss Guard.
The military life, I like it. And
you like the structure?
Yes, I like the structure, that's it.
And the discipline?
Yes, and also the uniform, I like wearing it, I like serving it.
EWTN News In Depth travels the globe to bring you stories important to your Catholic life. But we also pay attention to what's happening just outside the doors of the EWTN Vatican Bureau.
That is right. We don't have to go far sometimes to get really brilliant stories. And Monsi, one of my all-time favorite stories for In Depth was the Vatican Observatory. Now, first of all, what a great hidden secret of the Vatican that they have an observatory, one of the oldest in the world. What you will see in this is that what makes it so special is the head astronomer, Brother Guy Consolmagno, formerly of Harvard and MIT. He's out of this world.
Oh, that's funny. Out of this world.
Station, this is Isa PAO here in the Vatican. How can you hear me?
That dot of light is not just a pretty star.
Jules, Isa PAO in the Vatican. This is Space Station. We hear you loud and clear.
I can see in the sky things that are beautiful and familiar and have a history and smile at me and remind me that God makes good things. This call to try to understand the universe is a divine call. That is the basis on which we have the courage to be scientists.
Surrounded by the majestic papal gardens on the site of the Pope's former summer residence at Castel Gandolfo is a department of the Vatican that most people don't even know exists. For here, in this heavenly setting, the Vatican Observatory examines the heavens. Brother Guy Consolmagno is a former lecturer at Harvard and MIT. Now a Jesuit, he is the director of the Vatican Observatory.
We've got 12 astronomers, most of them Jesuits. There are a couple of diocesan priests who work with us. And we all have doctorates from different universities from around the world. We come from four continents. We do science ranging from, the Planck time of the first 10 to the minus 43 seconds before that time, after the Big Bang, to dust that hits the top of the Earth's atmosphere now and everything in between.
And it's not just here in Castel Gandolfo. Across the Atlantic Ocean in Arizona in the United States, the Vatican purchased this state-of-the-art telescope where priests and brothers with degrees in the sciences, maths and engineering capture awe-inspiring images like these.
Why does the Vatican have an astronomical observatory?
Don't you think every major religion should support astronomy? The answer is deeper than that, of course. In 1891, Pope Leo XIII deliberately established a Vatican observatory. Astronomy was a field that the Vatican already had, a really strong international reputation. And this was to show the world that the church was not against science, and also to show the world that the Vatican was a nation with a national observatory.
So it was part scientific and part political.
As most of these things are. The thing that, the reason we continue to have a Vatican Observatory is to continue to remind the peoples in the pew that we are not anti-science, that the church not only supports science, but the church is mother of science in many ways, because science began in the universities.
And in the observatory's headquarters, they even have a museum documenting the Vatican's contribution to science and astronomy dating back as far as 1582 and the Gregorian reform of the calendar.
This is the first telescope that the observatory got in 1891, and it was installed in a little dome on the Tower of the Winds. So this was back in Vatican City, and in fact, the first telescopes were on the walls of the Vatican City. We didn't move out here until the 1930s.
They also have one of the major collections of meteorites in the world, with over 1,100 pieces from the depths of space.
I get to have my hands on pieces of outer space, and that never stops being a thrill. So we're in the dome of the Schmidt telescope, which is actually just a giant photographic camera. And it was the final telescope installed here at the Vatican. It was put in here in the late 50s. And Pope Pius XII personally bought this telescope out of his family funds, not Vatican funds.
Another incredible piece of history about this room, it is where Pope Paul VI spoke to the astronauts.
The Apollo astronauts on the moon.
Wow.
He was standing, actually sitting, exactly right where you are. First, a blessing in Latin, and then a message to the astronauts in English, referring to the moon as the pale goddess of our dreams.
Wow.
It was beautiful, it was poetic.
Paul VI is speaking to you, astronauts. Greetings and blessing to you, conquerors of the moon.
It was a beautiful, beautiful moment.
Brother Guy is from Detroit, Michigan, and entered school in 1959, the year the Russians launched the first satellite, Sputnik.
You're unique. You're probably one of the only people in the world who is wearing a Roman collar and an MIT ring. So let's go back. You grew up in Michigan, in the United States of America. Were you always interested in science? I know you call yourself a Sputnik kid.
I started kindergarten the year that Sputnik went up.
1957.
I was, going to grade school when someone would bring in a portable television, which was, bigger than I am now, so we could watch the launches of the Mercury and the Gemini capsules. How could you not be fascinated with science? I grew up in a time when anything was possible.
Very fine-grained as you get close to it. It's almost like a powder.
But I was also fascinated with my religion. Not just a part of my religion, but fascinated by it. In the sense, in the nerdly sense of the nuts and bolts, how does this work? Because the deep thing is, you're not going to prove God with science. God is bigger than science. God can't be proved by science. God proves that science works, not the other way around.
And for Brother Guy, his love for astronomy has a deeper, more personal meaning.
My father lived to be 100, my mom to 97.
Wow.
Both of them were tremendous role models to me. I was very close to my father in so many ways. He wanted to be an astronomer, but in the Depression, that wasn't going to happen.
Would he look at the stars at night with you?
My father knew the stars. He had learned them as a kid. And then he was a navigator with the Army Air Corps during World War II. So the stars were both a source of pleasure, but also a very important part of very deadly business.
Do you think about him now when you peer through the telescopes?
All the time. All the time I think of him. And there's not a week goes by when there isn't something that I want to tell him about. Something that I know he'd be really, delighted to hear about.
What did he think of the work you were doing?
I hope he was proud, not that I was at the Vatican or knew the popes or whatever, he enjoyed that, but just that I was able to do the astronomy that he'd always wanted to do.
The Vatican Observatory has just launched a new website with beautiful pictures and a podcast, and they have a yearly mentoring program for future generations of astronomers and scientists all over the world.
It's amazing that you've been doing this for almost 5 decades, but you still have such enthusiasm and passion for it. It hasn't faded.
If you ever lose the passion for what you're doing, then you've lost the reason to do it. But in astronomy, It's easy. Just go outside at night and look up.
And of course, we couldn't tell beautiful stories like this without talented photojournalists. We're so pleased to introduce EWTN News photographer Patrick Leonard. You two work together on most of Column's reports. Give us a behind-the-scenes look at what it is that you do and how you do it.
Well, Monsi, I think I prefer to be on the other side of the camera, but it's great to be here all the same.
We're so glad you're here.
It's thanks
true.
For having
he,
me.
He doesn't like this one.
No. But we'll get through it. This was such a joy to work on this project. Brother Guy is an amazing character, and we wanted to do him justice in how we present the report. Mm. The visuals we used in this were, we wanted to make it look like something out of this world. So the lights we used, the creative lighting, the way we shot the B-roll, were all to try and move the story forward.
That's so beautiful.
And see the way on the monitor, you can see there, Patrick, isn't it true? You brought in these lights, it's like Star Wars.
Exactly,
almost.
Yeah.
Sometimes we have a beautiful location, but this time you had very little to work on.
This was actually the opposite. We usually, in our reports, we try to make the background, you know, beautiful. But this time we made the background very different. We actually darkened it. We made it look like something completely different, something out of this world.
To focus on what Brother Guy was saying, because he's such an intelligent guy and has so much to say. We said, let's just make the focus really on him.
Well, Colm, you found out something really special about him.
Yeah, as you saw in the report, and Patrick just, again, masterfully knowing when to go in for the close-up. I was doing the interview with Brother Guy, and I'd done my research, so I knew a bit about his story, and we were going through it, and I thought this was great. But it was at the end, Monsi, when I said, well, what is it like when you're working and meeting the Holy Fathers? And he then referenced his
because
own...
Because he's worked for three of them.
He's worked for three of them. And then he mentioned his own father, who grew up in the Depression in Detroit, and he said, Colm, my dad always wanted to be an astronomer, but it could never be a reality. He would show me the stars at night, and then I could see the tears in his eyes. And he said, so I think it's really special because I wonder what he is thinking now, looking down at me doing this. And for me, it stopped me in my tracks as an interviewer. And then I know this is just a beautiful piece. And then it's great knowing that Patrick is doing a great job of capturing all of that for the show and for the audience.
This story was about the intersection of faith and science, a wondrous topic. But you two have also explored the dark side of the world for EWTN News in depth. You had a difficult assignment in Albania. We'll share that report up next.
Now, the exploitation of people through human trafficking is a tragedy occurring across the globe even today. But, Monsi, there are moments of light, and we wanted our viewers to know about an incredible Catholic nun who is fighting with every fibre of her being to help those most innocent victims.
And as you've shared with us, with every challenge, our church really is on the front lines. You and Patrick traveled to Albania to find this courageous nun and tell us about her mission. Here's that story.
I was living in a neighborhood, and one night two guys I knew took me out for a coffee. They told me one of their friends had a car, and they invited me along.
This is a 17-year-old girl who is recounting her experience of being trafficked when she was just 16.
I thought they were my friends. But it was just a lie, a trick. They started giving me alcohol and then drugs. I would stay with them in a house. Then more guys started appearing.
And did you have any idea what was going on, or was it a case that because they were giving you alcohol and drugs, you would wake up maybe the next day or not know what had happened or what exactly they were doing?
I woke up in the morning and I couldn't see myself this way. I said, I cannot be this person. I cannot believe it. I don't feel like myself. This is not possible.
What kind of threats would they make towards you if you would leave or tell people what was happening?
They told me things like, I will come to your house and I will kill you. They also told me they had recorded videos of me. They said, we will post them on the internet and ruin you. I was destroyed.
Psicologique, physique.
Psychologically, physically.
Do aspect.
In every aspect.
The number of trafficked people in the world is increasing. Figures from the United Nations estimate that there are around 40.3 million people trafficked in the world today. They're trafficked for labor, marriages, babies, organs, and sex. Very few are detected and rescued, only around 1%. And it's in poorer countries like Albania in Southeast Europe that many girls and young women are tricked into leaving their homes after they meet a boy who promises them a better life abroad.
They are wooed with presents and a better life, a job in Italy maybe, and let's get married and let's go together and let's make a better life.
So this is a long-term project. So a boy would pretend to
maybe
be...
Maybe for a year.
...in love,
yes,
with the girl.
Absolutely.
Gain the trust of the family.
Mm.
Do you think she's a part of a ring of traffickers in Albania?
Sister Imelda Pool is a religious sister. Her order of nuns, Mary Ward Loreto, work to rescue and rehabilitate victims of human trafficking.
To hear that a human being has been so treated like a dog, like meat on the market, is just incredible in civilization today, you know, when we know better. But unfortunately, there's a cold heart around in the world.
The problem of trafficking is rooted in poverty. And Sister Imelda is bringing me to visit the home of a young woman called Aurora, who lives with her grandmother and her niece in a small town. They have very little. She earns around 250 euros a month. And she recalls to me a time when strange men followed her sister outside of school.
They followed her and took pictures of her. They wouldn't leave her alone.
They suspect that they were traffickers, looking for their next victim. These stories have become all too familiar for Sister Imelda, who has been working in Albania with trafficked victims for 16 years. What are the methods that the traffickers have for keeping them in their hold?
One of them is that they become afraid of their trafficker because of the massive abuse and the threatening and blackmail, that they will be found, that there is nowhere where they cannot be found. They beat them, they also drag them. It's very, very common for, especially somebody that's been trafficked for sex, that they will straight away rape them and drag them. So their kind of competence for good decision making is weakened.
Yeah. We work in the same.
It's kind of peer-to-peer.
Sister Imelda is having a meeting with representatives of other organizations that also work with trafficked victims. Some help them with housing, others education, and so on. They're all closely linked and work together to care for the victims as best they can.
If we start with a prayer, it helps us to be closer with the victims of human trafficking that we support.
Something that comes up in the meeting is one of the major obstacles to young women being reunited with their families after they've been trafficked. And that is the stigmas and shame that surround a trafficked girl. One of the organization leaders tells a story of a family she knows, where a man told his brother not to accept his daughter back into the home because she had been trafficked.
Brother will not talk to him. Not only his brother, but the whole relatives will not talk to this, to the father of this girl. That's why it's very difficult.
To better understand the honor system in certain Albanian families, I've come back to a rural village and I'm sitting down with Anna Staki, who is the CEO of the Mary Ward Loreto Foundation.
We have in these areas a very strong sense of honor
And the honor, it's usually related to the purity. She has to go virgin to her husband. In these families, or in these areas, honor, it's the more important thing, the most important thing. So they are poor, they might have nothing, but at least they have the honor. And she knows that. And it's very hard because that is used also for their continuous manipulation or coercion into exploitation, because she doesn't have anywhere to go now.
It's so sad, isn't it, that for most of these girls, they can't go back to their families, the ones they probably need the most.
Yeah, it's never an option.
The sophistication of the traffickers is getting more intelligent. The gangs of traffickers are getting stronger because they get more money from human trafficking than drug trafficking. They would have been the leaders in the drug trafficking and also weapon trafficking.
And why is that? Because nowadays, with more sophisticated detection equipment and processes, it's harder to traffic narcotics and weaponry, but maybe easier to traffic human beings.
Well, I think it's to do with greed and the money. You can sell a gun once and it's gone. But a human being, you sell over and over and over again, and you get a lot more money.
And then there are the individual traffickers, who can even sometimes be family members, prostituting their very own children. Sister Melda has come across a number of these cases. But the woman that you met, is the justification for just the dire poverty? And
yes, it is. It's
means to an end?
Yes, it's a means to an end. It's like the mother selling the baby, you know, for sex trafficking, the child, little child. You know, how could a mother do that? But the excuse or the argument will be, I'm feeding four other children. This one will suffer, but I'm feeding four other children.
It's a vicious cycle. Dire poverty and hunger can make moral lines become more blurred, and then the victims become numb to the pain.
It's a kind of almost automatic pilot, like a defense mechanism, but the trauma that leads to when they disassociate leads to a much longer recovery period.
In another part of the capital, Tirana, there is what's known as a social club for young women who have recently been rescued from trafficking. And today, there are around 10, roughly aged between 16 and 20 years old. One has a swollen black eye, but they're all smiling because for them, the main part of the nightmare is now over.
I am Natasha. I am from a long tour.
Now I am married and I have a child. I would like to say to all the girls who might experience something similar to have the courage to speak up. So a message to girls all over the world is that everything that has happened is in the past. The first time you experience abuse, report it.
Actually, there's always tears in a person's life that works in this, and I'm sorry. And many do make a life, you know. So it's a journey of a year, 2 years, 3 years or more, depending on the trauma that the person's experienced. But you can live in hope for these young people.
In Albania, Colm Flynn, EWTN News, In Depth.
I wanted to reach the really people who were in the worst position possible.
Next, to Africa. EWTN News In Depth travels to a leper colony in South Sudan. Colm's storytelling and Patrick's camera capture hope and inspiration at a home for outcasts.
We're back with Colm and Patrick. So, Africa. Colm, South Sudan is a difficult place to get to and a difficult place to travel in even before you get to the leper colony, right?
That is true. When the Holy Father announced that he was going to the Democratic Republic of Congo in South Sudan, we thought we wanted to go there and share the stories. But South Sudan, it is the youngest country in the world, established in 2011. A history of violence and a lot of brutality. Corruption there even today is widespread, which is something that was
extremely difficult for us to try and navigate as we made this report.
Absolutely. Well, Patrick, the imagery that you're about to see in this piece, it's just incredible. Beautiful faces, beautiful colors. Tell us about some of these shooting techniques that you used.
Yes, Monsi. And I think, as you know, as Callum said, one of the most challenging shoots we've ever had, but also one of the most rewarding. The South Sudan is a place with no power grid. So we're faced with challenges that we never faced before. You know, all of our TV equipment requires a lot of power. We're operating everything off batteries and trying to charge it during the day off a very weak solar panel. So a very unique experience. But despite all the challenges, the joy that we've seen on the ground with these kids was amazing. This is the first time a lot of these kids have ever seen a camera or had visitors, especially in the leprosy colony.
It's beautiful.
And as you see on screen here, this kid helped me out.
See, Patrick doesn't do all the work, Monsi. You see, sometimes he has some help. But you know what's interesting about this? And I remember this was a challenge for Patrick when he was filming. They were all fascinated by the camera. So when you went to film, they kept posing for the camera, coming to the camera.
Exactly. And we actually, in our reports, we try to give an authentic view and insight into what these people's lives are like. And that's difficult when every child is posing for a still photo.
So
we had to take a step back. Exactly. We had to take a step back and kind of look in from the outside.
I remember saying to Patrick, look, Patrick, you just go over there. I had another camera. I said, I'll keep everyone entertained and take photographs. So Patrick kind of, in a quiet way, is just waiting for a long time to zoom up with a lens and capture a moment of reality in the leprosy colony.
Right.
It was an incredible report. Yes.
So then, Colm, what were the people like?
This is one of the, and you know what, when I say it, I know it's a cliche, but it's a cliche for a reason, because it is so true. When you go somewhere like South Sudan, the people who sometimes have the least in this world have such incredible joy and warmth in their welcome to you and in their heart. And I think despite the incredible hardship you're about to see, you will see that beauty as well. So we can take a look at the report now.
Okay.
These young boys are cleaning the dirt from the door of their hut using their bare hands. These young girls are pumping life-saving water from a well. This man with disabilities is moving around in a homemade wheelchair. What you're watching is rare footage taken inside one of South Sudan's leprosy colonies. Under the sweltering African sun, this community here in the region called Rumbek live in dire poverty, where every day is a battle for survival. They live here with the disease leprosy, as they have been banished from other towns and villages, seen as unclean.
These people have been chased several times. Many of them have died from being eaten by hyenas. The places that they were living here, there was no doors, there was no shelter, so the animals could just come in at night, and you see they're attracted to the wounds.
This is Nolene Loughran, an Irish volunteer who has devoted herself to helping the 5,000 people who live in this colony, many of whom are missing fingers, hands and toes, and other limbs.
This is Mary. Mary, as you can see, has had leprosy. They had to cut her hands off. She's got 4 children, and this is her little house here. Now, believe it or not, this house is actually very good in standards of the people that live here. She has a bed, a homemade bed. It's not a bed as we know a bed, but it's still very good and very reasonable. Most people wouldn't have anything here.
Outsiders rarely get to see what life is like in a colony like this, but Nolene has granted us access.
Leprosy is something that you never hear about anymore.
No.
Whenever I think of leprosy, I think of the biblical references.
Yes.
But here in South Sudan, there still are huge patches of the community in certain areas.
There's huge amounts of leprosy here in South Sudan. But leprosy is caused by a combination of different things. One of them is hygiene. And if you have no system of hygiene, which there is absolutely no system here, I mean, in this particular area, there's about 4,900 people and there's one toilet.
They live here, Nolene, because they're not allowed to live in the city of Brumbeck, in the town, or kind of some of the more built-up villages. They have to have their own colony here.
All down through history, lepers have been chased away because of the particular kind of disease that it is. It's contagious, and also it carries a terrible smell from the rotten flesh.
It sounds horrific, but it's the reality. If the people here do not get their medication, their leprosy would get worse. Their skin rots and they become weaker and weaker. Nolene supplies the people with food and medication, collecting what she can from donors to pass on to the community.
10 kgs of beans, 20 kgs of pocho. They get oil, soap, sugar, tea, and salt.
And how long should that keep them going for?
That will only keep them going for 2 weeks, and that's stretching it, because most of these families have approximately 6 to 7 children. So you're talking that you're really only giving them one meal a day.
With the help of charities like the Sudan Relief Fund, the community here is able to survive. And even though they have nothing, they are filled with such joy and gratitude for the little help they do get. Growing up in Ireland, Nolene always dreamed about going to Africa to work with the poor. South Sudan is known all over the world because of the war, because of the unrest, because of the violence. Why did you want to come to a country like South Sudan?
Because it was the worst. I felt that I wanted to reach the really people who were in the worst position possible. And I believed that if nothing else, that my love and my heart for them could help them.
And even today, as we're doing this interview, we have our friends here from the National Police Service, the Army, who are protecting us. So even today, there still is the constant threat of danger.
Yes.
It's in the air.
It's constant here. It never leaves. It's a frightening place to live, but a wonderful place to live.
The people here know that Nolene is putting herself at great risk just being in South Sudan, a place where most will not come. And because of that, and the kindness and affection she shows towards them, they greatly respect and admire her.
Yeah, that you are the gift from God.
One little boy who has captured Nolene's heart is Tarkoch. He came here with his mother when they were chased away from the last place they lived.
And do you say your prayers?
Yeah.
What about this one?
Tarkoch has leprosy on his face, and he's also had a stroke.
Hey, Tarkoch, what do you call Nolene?
Auntie Nolene.
The people here have been told they're not welcome anywhere outside their community, except by one group, the Catholic Church. Every Sunday, they are welcomed in a church which is outside the community. The gospel message that everyone is equal in the eyes of God, regardless of how strong or weak you are, rich or poor, healthy or sick, is something Nolene tells them again and again.
Do you know how many times our Lord mentions you in the Bible? I said, do you know how special you were to him? And by, you know, talking to them about things like that, it lifted their confidence and their morale, and is proving to them that they're worth more.
Nolene, what does the future hold for you? Will you ever go back home, or is Africa now home?
My heart belongs with the poor, and whatever time I've got left, I'd like to continue giving myself to the people of God.
That's it for this special edition of EWTN News In Depth. We could not bring these great stories to you without talented colleagues willing to travel thousands of miles to explore our church's reach. Our thanks to you, Colm and Patrick, for being our eyes and ears out there in the world.
It's been a pleasure. And thank you so much, Monsi. It's been amazing being here with you and the team.
Yes, in the flesh.
Thanks, Monsi. It's been great to reflect on all these stories.
Thank you so much. Join us next week for more reports important to your Catholic faith. See you here on EWTN.